Hello, and welcome to the Inside Davies podcast for July the 22nd, 2022. This is episode number 120. On today's show, we'll be talking about the debut of the Chevy Blazer EV, the reveal of the Cadillac Celestiq, and the launch of the Lucid Air Grand Touring and Grand Touring Performance. I'm Dominic Ioni, Inside EV's forum moderator and Inside EV's editor. Joining us today is the effervescent Mr. Tom Malogny, Inside EV's editor and host of the YouTube channel, State of Charge. We also have the motivational Mr. Martin Lee from the EV News Daily podcast.
Let's do this!
Which is available on all the best podcast platforms. And of course, the congenial Kyle Connor joins us from the majestic, practically palatial halls of the European offices of AutoSpec Studios, where he produces high-voltage videos for a growing number of YouTube channels. Okay, so before we get going, I'd like to ask that you please subscribe to the channel. If you're watching us on YouTube, please hit that thumbs up button and ring that bell icon for notifications so you'll know immediately when a new video is published. If you're watching us on Twitch, you can also ring that bell icon for notifications. All right, so with that out of the way, welcome everybody.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning to my friend Jim, who's in the comments again today.
Awesome.
We're slightly out of order. Is that going to mess everybody up?
Do we need some move?
There you go. My OCD was kicking in.
And we match the artwork as well that you always put on Twitter before or after the show. So that's we've got a match.
All right. So let's kick this thing off today with the news, and then we'll get to what we've been driving this week, which is a lot. So the big news of the week has to be the debut of the Chevrolet Blazer EV. So we've seen a pretty good photo of the front of this before, and now we get to see absolutely everything and get a good amount of the details. So basically what we have here is a crossover that starts at $44,995. That's a little lower than the $47,000 average price that Americans are paying for cars in 2022. And this is the first Chevy to be introduced on the Ultium platform. It comes in four trims, LT1, LT2, RS, and SS. Plus, there's a police pursuit vehicle for law enforcement fleets. So the highest available range is 320 miles. The lowest is 247. Depending on the trim level. There are two battery sizes, but we don't have exact energy capacity figures yet. But perhaps the most interesting thing about this car is that it's available in front-wheel drive, rear-wheel drive, and all-wheel drive. So mostly that depends on the trim chosen. The LT1 is the small battery-only front-wheel drive. LT2 is front-wheel drive with optional all-wheel drive. And then when it gets to the RS trim, that's when it gets kind of interesting. It comes standard with front-wheel drive, but also standard with rear-wheel drive, with its availability dependent upon battery pack size. The rear-wheel drive RS trim is also the one with the longest range. That's 320 miles, despite coming on 21-inch wheels. And the SS, of course, only comes in all-wheel drive and blazes to 60 miles an hour in less than 4 seconds. The two LT and RS will go on sale first in the summer of 2023. That's like next year, probably a little less than a year from now. Priced from $47,595 and $51,995 for those two. The SS follows later in 2023, priced at around $65,995, followed in Q1 2024 by the LT1. So Tom, what do you make of this Chevy Blazer EV? Home run, base hit, strikeout?
Well, I think it's great that they're electrifying the Blazer. I'm not a fan of the styling. You know, the Blazer to me growing up was like Ford had the Bronco and Chevy had the Blazer. And those were like the competing vehicles, like if you were going to get that type of vehicle. And Ford's like knocked it out of the park style-wise with the Bronco. And this just doesn't do it for me. Like this could be a Mazda. It could nothing wrong with that. I mean, it's just like, come on, it's the Blazer, you know? And I mean, they did this. They didn't just bring it back now. They brought the Blazer back, you know, a few years ago. And I felt that way about the styling, you know, and it's kind of weird with standard with front wheel drive. Like, who wants a Blazer with front wheel drive? Like, I don't know. I'm glad they electrified it, but I probably, if I was, you know, program manager of Blazer EV, I might have made different choices.
Hmm. So is it the Blazer that you feel that is the different from the Trailblazer?
Yeah, well, the Trailblazer was a little smaller, right? The Chevy Trailblazer was like, you know, it was the Blazer, and then there was the Trailblazer. So right. that this is the design language that Chevy has been bringing out with that line for a few years now, and it just doesn't. I don't know. It just doesn't do it for me. Maybe other people like it better, but I was disappointed when I first saw it. Now I'm just not really, I'm even less enthusiastic about it. I think some of the specs are good. Styling is subjective, but for me, I just, I look at Ford, what Ford did with the Bronco. Now they didn't electrify it yet. They're going to, obviously, but to me, I'm just not, this doesn't move it for me. It doesn't do it for me. The stats are good. I'm glad it's electric. They have to do this. I'm happy with some of the things they've done with the vehicle, but overall, you wouldn't see this in my driveway personally, but like I said, style subjective. I'm sure some people love it.
Yeah. I don't know. Maybe what if it was called something else? Cause they definitely didn't follow up on the off-road or the adventure aspect to the nameplate, right? Like where Bronco, Ford went all in on the Bronco and made like a incredible like off-roading, kind of beast. And this is not at all that. This is like a soft roader, we'd say, like a mall cruiser. I don't know, Kyle. Yeah,
and like I said, I hate to sound so negative. It's just my personal impression when I look at it. This doesn't do it for me. And we're honest here, and we give people our personal opinions. Some of the stats I think are good. I think it probably will do well. The front wheel drive thing is super weird to me. I can't imagine driving around this in the front wheel drive version. Like to me, front wheel drive's for like little economy cars, but like not family crossover or SUVs, but I haven't driven it. Maybe I'd be surprised. I think it probably should have been rear wheel drive and all wheel drive. But like I said, I'm not program manager for Blazer EV.
Right. I tweeted out the story and I mentioned, I was also had similar feelings about front wheel drive, but I got a lot of feedback. There's a lot of people out there who really like front wheel drive, who want front wheel drive, even if, they feel it's better in the snow. They like the driving characteristics of it, I guess. I don't know exactly. I think, Kyle, we need to get you like a front wheel drive, like the RS. We get you a front wheel drive one and a rear wheel drive one, but the same tires, and benchmark how they, how they work in the snow.
Yeah, I think that's a video we're planning on doing. Early winter is to explain or at least show why maybe you don't need front wheel drive. Maybe rear wheel drive is better, depending for an EV chassis. So yep, that's a good video. We're thinking about it.
Or maybe it isn't even better. Maybe front wheel drive is better. Like some people are very adamant that front wheel drive is, even we talk about the physics of it all, when you take off the weight, goes from the front to the back. In a front wheel drive car, traditionally you have like the engine sitting on top of the front wheels, so that gives you traction for the front wheels, and they'll pull you through some deep snow.
But it's also like vehicle dynamics control as well. Like personally, I would prefer rear wheel drive because you can control yaw angle or slip angle with accelerator pedal, whereas with front wheel drive you don't have that ability in loose weather, but it's easier to control for most people because if it starts to understeer, you just lift off. So there's trade-offs. These are the decisions that are going on whenever a company decides to figure out where to put a motor. And sometimes everything's a compromise. Sometimes the front wheel drive is the correct choice.
So it sounded to me like maybe the front wheel drive version of this is going to have a smaller battery. Does that make sense? Like the little asterisk besides the rear wheel drive, in specs on the we have it's on the page there, Martin. I don't know if you want to bring it up or not on our story on Inside EVs for the debut post. We have a bunch of different charts with the different trim levels and the features involved they all have. Anyway, on the
my comment on if we have to have a chart with different feature levels and explain it, then it's already too complicated for this stage of the EV adoption. We see all car manufacturers rationalizing their choices coming out of the factory, whether it's Tesla's three paint colors, I jest, of course, more coming out of Berlin, they say, with the new paint shop they bought. But you know, whether it's with the various options, Ford F-150, you know, Lightning is the most recent example of, right, here's a few options. Which one do you want? And then you start layering in. Here we go. I'll put it up on screen. A bunch of extra options. Front wheel drive and rear wheel drive and all wheel drive seems overly excessively complicated to me. But as Tom says, I think he summed it up best, none of us are the program manager for this, right, getting paid the big bucks to make that decision. So they obviously have a good reason why, and they understand their customers better than all of us. So there must be a reason, but it already seems too complicated if we're putting up charts and explaining things.
Right. So the chart we're looking at right now, just at the very bottom, we can't see it here, but there's like a little asterisk, and it says about the battery capacity. We can't read that on the screen. It's very tiny print. But see, I have it in my notes again. Right. Depending on the battery available pack size. Availability dependent on battery pack size. So it doesn't sound like they're fully confident they'll have battery availability for pack. I don't know why. It's a weird asterisk. I don't know. But I think for me, anyway.
It's probably too premature to really dig into it right now, because I don't even think we know what the mix they're planning on producing will be for the car, front wheel drive, all wheel drive, or rear. I think it's cool. It's the first example that we've seen, you know, saying, hey, we got motors in all spots. Why don't you figure out where you want them to go? Honestly, Polestar should have done this and offered a rear wheel drive option for some people.
That would be cool. That would be nice, I think. Yeah, so the LT2 and the RS are the first ones to go on sale, and I think the RS is like the really the one to get, because it's got, you know, all the cool features like standard that the L1 LT and 2 LT don't have, because they all have LED lighting all the way around. But with the RS and the SS, you get this hands-free lift gate, and you don't even have to put your foot underneath it. You just have to approach the tailgate and it lifts up. I'm not sure how that works though, because like, what if you don't want the tailgate to lift up and you're walking by? I don't know.
Oh, Hyundais do this, and sometimes they just open when you don't want them to.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
that's great. Yeah. So Martin, this is like, what do you think about this? This is kind of like not coming to Britain that I know about, or is it?
Yeah, no, it won't do. But it's all the specs are right, and I think the specs are right for a car coming out in 2023 or 2024 for the base version, and still being relevant 5 years in. Like, we're still talking about the Bolt being on sale and the EUV being on sale. We had a story about that this week about something somebody asked someone from the company, you know, will it go? And their response was, well, yes, of course, the product will have an end. And then, you know, the story is the Bolt is going. Well, of course the Bolt is going, unless the Bolt's going to be here in 20 years' time, then of course it's going. But it will be around for the foreseeable, which was their response, which that's not kind of a non-story. It's going to be around for the foreseeable. It's not going anywhere. And even though it's kind of wildly out of date now, it's still a great car if you can get it for the discounts they're offering now on the 2023 model year. And this, I think, is future-proof. So really fast charging. So 190 kilowatt DC fast charging on this. I think it looks great, looks fine, and all the specs, nice big 17-inch odd screen inside it. You know, it all looks good. What I'm interested from you guys, I don't know if any of you can explain, is who buys this car? So who buys a Blazer? Because we don't get that here. And what will this car be cross-shopped against?
I was going to say Cadillac Lyric.
No, I think it's directly ID4, Ioniq 5. This world, it might be slightly bigger, but even just for charging speed, like I drove ID5 over here where I am now, and I just plugged it into Ionity and 181 kilowatts. So we're not far off on the charging speeds.
Whoa,
here.
New software.
Yeah, 3.1.
That's amazing.
And the GTX, I think 3.1 only allows faster charging on GTX. We'll talk about it later, but we're in this range now.
Oh, sweet. That's Volkswagen ID4, right?
Or ID5. Yeah.
ID5, right. Well, that's a coupified ID4, basically, right?
Same car. So that kind of charging speed is, you know, fit for the future, right? That'll do us for the next 5 years or so, whatever this car is going to be used for. That's a perfectly fine charging speed. And then let the battle, the race for fast charging, head off into the distance with more expensive cars or non-family cars. But yeah, as Kyle says, this is absolutely 200 kilowatts is fine. You know, and if you can go faster, then congratulations. But that's all good for most people of this vehicle.
Yeah, I think 200, and it all depends too how long it stays, the power levels stay up at that, you know. But yeah, 190 is great. It's got a 11.5 onboard AC charger, which is a bit smaller than the Lyriq 20 kilowatt charger, but you know, that's fine. You expect this to be a little bit down range from the Cadillac Lyriq. I'm not sure anything else we want to say about this. Anything else? It's got wide open Watts, so it's like a 4 second or under 4 seconds. I think it competes with the Tesla Model Y, actually. I'm looking for the dimensions. I don't see the dimensions up here yet. But the gasoline version of this is pretty long, like 192 inches. So it's quite a decent size.
Yeah, I think it's similar to the Y, bigger than some of the other cars we're talking about, like Mach-E and ID4. It's probably close to the Y.
Yeah, I'm not seeing, there's no dimensions yet. So we don't see like the cargo space yet, I don't think, right? Well, okay. So who wants to talk about that anymore then? Hey, sorry, Chevy. Okay. I don't know. I think it'll, so it's been on sale for a few days and it hasn't sold out yet. So that tells you either people aren't interested as much as there have been other things, or they're planning on making a lot of them. So, you know, they haven't reached the end of, you know, the well of possible buyers is deep in that case. I don't know. Yeah. I guess we'll have to see. So there we go. So let's move.
I was just checking the updated show notes, and we haven't got the Ford announcement in here from yesterday, have we? Correct me if I'm wrong.
Oh no,
but that's fine. So in short, they've just secured a new battery supply contract with CATL for 600,000 vehicles capacity by the end of 2023, and 2 million vehicles by the end of 2026, which. And done some deals for raw materials for lithium in North America and Australia, et cetera, et cetera. Ford are doing all the right things, and now they're talking about it, which is, here's our battery supply contract, new contracts as well with LG and SK, but the big one was to go for the LFP packs from CATL to power the Mustang Mach-E, the Ford F-150 Lightning, the Transit, and 30,000 of the small European car based on the VW platform. So look, Ford are doing all the right things, getting the battery supply contracts and then releasing the numbers of the cars they'll be able to make by the end of next year. Whereas the thing that we don't fully understand is that ramp up for GM, because, you know, tons and tons of press this week with the Blazer launch, because, you know, they once again insist they're going to be bigger than Tesla by 2025. And not that we're picking favorites here, but if you ramp where Tesla are today and where they're going to go to 2025, and then what we know about GM, it's physically impossible from what they've told us in terms of their installed capacity. So there must be stuff they aren't ready to tell us yet, because if they want to be bigger than Tesla, who just increased Shanghai from 450,000 cars to 750,000 cars a year out of one facility, 250,000 in Berlin, 250,000 in Texas, and they're going to grow as well as adding 10% to Fremont and more gigafactories. So they keep saying, we're going to be bigger than Tesla by 2025. Well, you got 3 more years to do it. Just tell us how you're going to do it. Because at the minute, the numbers do not stack up. Just logically, they don't stack up. Whereas Ford, again, they talked a big game. They're backing it up. So it's great that these cars are coming out, and let's hope that they've got the capacity to produce an absolute ton of them, which is all we want from all the car makers.
I think GM's statement is like, they want to be bigger than Tesla in the US. So they're just talking about the US factory output for Tesla. So that limits Tesla to Fremont and Austin.
Which they might do. You take China out and that's such a massive, Berlin
and
will be bigger.
And Berlin, but.
So but yeah, and they might be able to do it.
It's still pretty close to
make that clear. You know, I read, I think it was either an AP article or a PA article that then got syndicated out, and it went everywhere. And I was like, right. I keep seeing this headline. Every time I open my Twitter, I'm seeing another person sharing a link saying, hey, we're going to be bigger than Tesla. And I'm like, come on a minute. But maybe they could do in just the US.
But for 2 million cars of battery capacity for Ford 2026, that seems like pretty significant. That's like a good number. I don't know. What do you think?
It was 70% of the way there. So they've got more to announce, but they've announced 70% of their capacity for 2 million cars, which is all we want to hear. You know, and they're going back to do lithium deals and mining deals and raw materials deals, which is what we've all been saying for years, which is the move from combustion to EV requires you to be a different kind of company. Great car companies until now have been really good at assembling lots of bits just in time and getting them out of the door. And the move to EV requires you to go into a different level of detail of your supply chain. And some have worked that out. The Fords, VWs, Teslas of the world. Raw materials were arriving at Tesla like 6, 7, 8 years ago. Like, no one, people talk about it now because they're making their own batteries. But Tesla have big, big experience in buying and processing raw materials. Those trucks have been turning up at Nevada for donkey's years. So look, there's some that get it and some that don't. And then you've got some others that, you know, that just want to go to the market. Like BMW have often talked about, we just want to let a battery market establish itself, then we'll go to the market and we'll purchase batteries, which, you know, I think is the wrong thing to do, but that's their take.
Right.
Well, Morten, it's the model they've followed for decades. You know, is just, if, you know, we'll build the cars and we'll find suppliers to buy stuff from, but the EV changes that whole paradigm. You know, you can't just go out and get a supplier. You've got to plan years ahead of time and build the infrastructure for it. So, and you know, it's, I think, and it's not that they're stupid and they didn't know that. It's just that I really believe, and I have the opportunity, and so do some of you guys, to talk to some of the product planners, you know, throughout the last few years. And I genuinely think most people that worked in these, not everyone, because I met a lot of people that were really understood what was going to happen. I think most people that were in charge at the legacy brands didn't fully understand how quickly this switch to electrification was going to be. And that, well, we'll have time, you know, like we'll put these EVs out, you know, we'll make 100,000 this year, 300,000 next year, 400,000 next year, 500,000, 15 years from now, we'll be making a couple million EVs. I really genuinely don't believe that they realize that most people understood that this was going to, we were going to get the hockey stick adoption rate, you know, where it was going to go right up a little bit and then just go zoom, you know, and that's what we are kind of at the edge of now. The next 3 or 4 years, we're going to see incredible, you know, there's going to be demand's going to far outstrip supply and have nothing to do with supply chain and everything. So I think finally the manufacturers are getting it, and Ford might have been one of the first ones of U.S. manufacturers. I think Volkswagen understood that years ago too, or they were forced into it with the whole Dieselgate thing. We'll never know the true story on that, but I think Ford really does get it. Does GM get it? Perhaps, but I think Ford is showing their hand now that they understand the next 6, 7 years is just going to see incredible increases in their electric vehicle sales and demand.
Right. All right. So, see, okay. Hope you don't mind if we move on to the next thing. Anyone have anything else to say on the Ford announcement?
Yes. Nope. Also, that there was a Car and Driver article yesterday, which Ford didn't confirm or deny, that since the Ford split into two, into the EV bit and the Blue Oval bit, that they're going to lose 8,000 people from the Blue Oval bit. In other words, the combustion bit of the company. Jim Farley gave a company address, I think it's 7 a.m. Thursday morning, yesterday morning, which talked about the need to change, but didn't directly address 8,000 people losing their jobs. So that might or might not be confirmed. I like the source of that story, as I trust that website. But what a terrible time if you're working in the oily bits, the old bit of any car company, and you know, you go to work each day, you're proud, you make great engine cars, and you know, that's what you've done maybe your whole career, and all of a sudden you're kind of on the chopping block because you're in the wrong bit of the company. And, you know, I'm fully aware that we're on Inside EVs right now, so we've all been talking about electric cars for a long time, but I think that would clearly is awful news for a lot of people. But that's how they will fund the move to EV, right, and split the company. But I've seen no official statement from them on that, but obviously we're thinking of those people who might lose their jobs because of this move to EV. So that was the final comment on that.
All right.
I've seen Volkswagen Group and BMW come out with similar statements, maybe not as strong, in the past about how this transition is going to mean it's going to be a seismic change in how our employment lays out in the company, you know, and that didn't sit well with the German unions at all, you know, but it's going to happen, you know, and the companies are going to have to understand that with when you get a sea change like this, like something that changes so much, it's inevitable. If the companies are going to survive, they have to reallocate funds and they have to put money and workers in different positions. Hopefully, you know, they'll be able to move some of those workers into new positions, but a lot of jobs are going to be eliminated.
Yeah. All right. So the Blazer is only one of two Ultium platform vehicles that was that were revealed this week. So just a little while ago, Cadillac took the wraps off its Celestiq flagship. So this is a, I don't know if you can find that, Martin. It's on our homepage now. It's a couple stories down. So this is a halo vehicle that will be built by hand in limited numbers, and it's rumored to cost as much as $300,000. We don't have the official pricing yet, but that and some other details are only going to be released a little bit later this year. So I saw a version of this car in person in early 2020 at GM's EV Day, just before the pandemic really hit, and I remember being struck up by how like big it was, and it has like in person, it has a strong presence. There's a lot going on here with the exterior design, but I think it's the interior that really sells the car. And if you're watching us on YouTube, or if you're not watching us on YouTube, we're showing pictures of the exterior right now, but we'll get to the interior in a moment. They didn't release a ton of photos altogether, but enough to give you a basic idea of what we're dealing with here. So firstly, there's definitely some switchwear and trim that's also in the Lyric, and like that front grille, of course, on the outside. And a few of the other style elements that are very Cadillac. But yeah, they got that dark ash on the inside that's like laser cut for lighting to shine through in certain places. That's very much like the Cadillac Lyric. But the 55-inch screen spans the entire dash, but it has like this digital electronic blinds on the passenger side so they can watch a movie and or other content without it being visible to the driver. So that's kind of cool. Cadillac says some of these technologies will included preview features that will come in the other vehicles. So when that Escalade size SUV launches, you can pretty much bet it's going to have like a big screen like that in there too. So Kyle, what are your thoughts on the Celestiq here? Do you think it can fulfill its halo car mission and bring identity and improve desirability to the brand?
Yes, I think every brand needs a halo car, and so it's a great thing to have something that hopefully will make to series production, and hopefully someone can drive something like this one day. Yeah, I'm all about halo cars. I think it gives the company a purpose. It gives the engineer something fun and cool to work on that can have a trickle-down approach. Even if they make no money from a project like this, hopefully this can make its way into future product. And honestly, let's be real, GM hasn't had anything crazy exciting except for Corvette for years, and they've always had cool projects that they worked on. The 80s, the 90s with digital gauges, speakers in the headrest. They were doing crazy stuff back then. I think this can spark the new engineering spirit to happen back at the company, and I'm all for it.
Man, this is just like a luxury ride, though. The details and just it's a four-seater too, right? And it looks like from the side, from the profile, I think it looks like a shooting brake. It's so long, and that rear overhang is so long, and the front one's short. But yeah, like, is that a wagon? But it's like a four-seater, but like proper luxury four-seat. You know, it's like, I don't know. yeah, I can imagine every seat's heated and ventilated and cooled, and I think they'll have every possible feature they can imagine jammed into this thing, and they'll sell. I mean, they're only going to make they're rumored to be only making like less than 500 a year, which is, you know, they're hand building, so that kind of makes sense. But yeah, I don't know. I think it's going to be popular amongst, you know, entertainment celebrities, and I think some executives, I don't know if they're going to sell this in China. Imagine, right? Because it looks like a, you know, Chinese executive car. Like, I don't know what you could ask more than this. Tom, is Cadillac a big brand in China?
Well, it's definitely highly regarded. I mean, the funny thing is, I think Buick is regarded as more of a luxury brand than Cadillac in China. But that there's a long history to that. But yeah, I saw Cadillacs when I was in China. Yeah, I agree with Kyle in the point that you know, these brands should have halo vehicles, and hopefully all the tech that's getting packed in here is a learning experience, and it trickles down into their other vehicles, kind of like i8, i3 for BMW. You know, those vehicles were low production, super expensive to build, but BMW learned a lot about engineering EVs working with carbon fiber. So you can't look at, you know, oh, they didn't make money. You know, you have to be able to amortize the learnings over the entire product line. So hopefully GM will learn a lot and be able to transfer technology to other vehicles. I don't really love it. It's cool in the fact that it's modern and it's retro. Like this wouldn't be, with a couple of tweaks, this could be a concept car from the 50s.
Yeah.
You know, with add some chrome and some fins, like, and it could have been something that they put out in the 50s. So I like it in that regard. I do hope that, the only thing I could say is, you know, we need affordable electric vehicles, you know, $25,000 electric vehicles. I just hope money that went into this program wasn't budget that was taken out of driving down the price of EVs and getting massive amounts of affordable electric vehicles out. Now, probably isn't the case. You know, I'm just, you know, that's the only thing that I'm saying, that I hope that wasn't the case with this. I think GM should have a halo vehicle. Will they sell 500 or 600 a year? I guess 500 or 600, such a small amount. But this is going to have, if it does launch at $300,000, it is going to have a very small market of people that might be interested in this. I think I might take, if it ever gets built, a Faraday Future before this, which, you know, I've driven in, and that's super, you know, incredible, ultra luxury on the inside. You know, even if I was an executive and I wanted to be, chauffeured around, I might take that before this. But we haven't seen the production version of this.
Right. This does remind me a bit of the Faraday Future FF91 in some respects, like just like maybe the overall shape or something, especially in the rear. But I mean, the Faraday Future one, I think it's going to be a bit, is it four-seater, the Faraday Future?
I think you can get it in both configurations. The executive seating is the four seat. And that's really, you know, what would sell mostly in China, as you mentioned. And that's why they probably show executive seating for this.
Right. I kind of like it. I don't know if it's going to, I mean, it's going to have like at least 100 kilowatt hours battery. I don't know. Maybe they'll custom make a battery for this so they can stick 200 kilowatt hours in the hell, but not have like the, not stack it up like it is in the Hummer. I don't know. We'll have to see. But yeah, this is out of my budget. So let's move on to something else that's not in my budget. So Lucid launched its Air Grand Touring and Grand Touring Performance trims this week. So we have first drive write-ups on both Inside EVs and MotorOne.com. So two different perspectives to share. Grand Touring and Grand Touring Performance, they're both like 819. Grand Touring is 819 horsepower. Performance adds some. So it's 1,050 horsepower, 0-60 times, or 3 seconds flat, or 2.6 in the GTP. So I don't know, Tom, at 154,000 for the Grand Touring and 179,000 for the Performance, seems to basically be taking the place in the lineup of the sold out Air Dream Edition, which is just a little bit more expensive, but has slightly higher power levels and a 0-60 that was a tenth of a second quicker. Is there something else that differentiates them here?
Not that I know of specifically. And I think part of that price is that when Lucid was originally planning their whole price structure, they weren't accounting for the incredible difficulties with, you know, supply chains and increasing costs of everything. I think if we didn't see all that, there might be a little bit of a bigger delta between the Dream Edition price and this. But, you know, as far as performance-wise, I drove the Dream Edition Performance, 1,111 horsepower. I didn't drive this. I wasn't able to attend this press drive, but quite honestly, you know, 0-60 in 2.6 seconds, the average person can't tell the difference between 2.1 and 2.6 seconds and doesn't really need that. But we don't need the kind of speed that we're putting out with Model S and all these crazy fast cars. You know, I think personally, I probably wouldn't go for this version. I would get the base Lucid Air, the less expensive one. You get pretty much
pure,
you know, 90% of the content that you get for $150,000 at much less. Now, yeah, the lower price trims aren't available yet, But if I was looking for a Lucid, that's what I would do. I would wait and just get the lower price one. Fantastic car, drives amazingly. You know, I spent a lot of time in it. I thought that the Lucid, you know, it you can't feel the weight and the heft and the turns and everything. The thing drives like a sports car. It goes forever. It's incredibly efficient. You know, I think it's really a wonderful, wonderfully designed and engineered vehicle.
Yeah, both our reviews remark about, you know, just it's handling in like in the canyons that had it on Skyline. I think Seth Miersma, our editor in chief, drove it on the Skyline and was, I think he was quite surprised actually that something this like heavy and long, you know, handled so well. So, I mean, it's got that going for it. So I guess this just replaces then the Dream Edition, and yeah, and they're making them now, so you can still get like a pretty top spec Lucid if you're in the market for something that at that level. So I guess I don't know if you want to say anything about this, Kyle. Kyle looks like he's having a good conversation there, and you're in Leipzig now, right?
I'm at Porsche Experience Center Leipzig, and yeah, the family just came up to ask to take a photo, and I called Jordan to arrange that. Lucid Air. I have nothing to say. I haven't really driven it. No clue what it's about. No clue if it's good, bad. I think it's not the most pretty car. But seems cool. I just have no experience really aside from one short drive a long time ago. So I know some viewers have them, and I'm going to be arranging a drive with some viewers pretty soon. They're going to let us borrow their car and make some videos with it.
Oh, sweet. I think one of our viewers, Doctor2, yeah, he just drove his, he just has a little comment here too. He just drove his 3,100 miles. He picked it up and drove it like straight across the country. And he says for the first time he had no body fatigue after driving it for, you know, 5-6 hours a day. So that's pretty cool. That's a pretty good, a strong statement of, you know.
Yeah, I mean, everything seems good on paper, but we just have to test it. So. Sure. You know, to be totally transparent, Lucid isn't the most communicative on our side. So I said, no worries. We'll just find some viewers. Thankfully, we have them. And now the fun stuff will start as soon as we can borrow a car. Can't wait.
All right. So let's move along. So VW has confirmed that the ID4, which it's building in Chattanooga, Tennessee, will have a more affordable version with a smaller 62 kilowatt hour battery that's already offers in other market. In other markets like Europe, this could bring the price down to the $35,000 neighborhood. So we don't have an official range figure yet, but we think it should get at least 200 miles. So, Martin, have you seen any real-world tests done with the small battery ID4 in Europe?
I've seen no real-world YouTube videos of the small battery, but that's because we don't have enough people like Kyle and Tom making videos over here. Maybe somebody should start doing those kind of tests. But I've seen plenty of written reviews, and that's a really interesting point, isn't it? Because actually, our small battery is 52 kilowatt hours, and you were saying that the Chattanooga one is 62. Is that right?
Well, it's 62 gross, so the usable might be down around 57, I think.
Yeah, so our small battery, our battery sizes are 52 and 77 usable. So, look, 52 gives you 145 horsepower, 0 to 60 in about 11 seconds, about 213 miles range WLTP. But we all know it gets a little bit nippy. You're going to lose some, do a bit of elevation, you'll lose some. You drive it in a hurry, you're going to lose some. But is the trade-off on the price worth it? And I really hope so. So there's a couple of big bonuses coming here. First of all, the car will be made domestically in the US, which is brilliant. So not importing from Germany and with a small battery. If they can get it anywhere near $35,000, and of course, VW still gets the tax credit if the full amount applies to you and your personal situation, it's absolutely brilliant value for, I think, most people's driving. So it comes with this, over here, the small battery comes with a smaller motor as well. And so there are some compromises, but it depends what you want a car for. Like, you know, EVs can do so much that I think there's an expectation that they do everything, because if you get the small entry level, you know, 1.6 or 1.4 liter, you know, small entry level version of any combustion car, and then try and drive it like the top spec, you're going to rag the thing. It's going to be screaming for its life. And that, yet EVs are kind of expected to do everything. So like, give the entry level car a break if it's at a great price. So like, if it is a decent sized battery that's got maybe that psychological 200 miles EPA is what they're aiming for with the bigger battery than the European one, it is that debate that we all have all the time, which is how much battery is enough battery? How much range do you want versus need? And want and need are very different things. So, yeah, bring it on. Cheaper prices for US buyers, exactly what we need with this car.
Definitely. And I agree, too. But one of the things that I think is important is at the dealership level, they need to talk to the customer and say, ask them, do you have home charging? What's your charging plan? I know that's pie in the sky, probably not going to happen, but I think it's important that they put the customers in the vehicle that is going to suit their needs. If somebody goes for the smaller battery ID4, but they really don't have the right infrastructure for it, they're going to rely totally on public charging and they need to drive 500 miles a week. And, you know, they haven't sorted this out yet. The dealers really should be able to explain to them why this might not be the right choice for you. And, you know, that's probably not going to happen because they're just looking to make a sale. And if somebody comes in and says, that's the EV I want, done deal, sign the papers out the door. But I think it's important if there's two battery sizes for dealers to begin a conversation with the customer of how do you know how much you drive a year? Do you know how many miles you drive a week? What's your daily routine? Where are you going to be charging this? Get to know the customer a little bit. They never had to deal with that before because they never had to ask them, you know, how far do you drive? You know, where do you get gas? But with electrification, it's completely different, as we know, and not enough dealers are finding out that information. And what you're going to have is customers that are going to say, you know what, EVs suck. Like this thing, I can never get it charged. It doesn't go far enough. In the winter, it only went 140 miles. You know, that's 2 days of driving for me, and I can't plug in at home. So I think it's really important. I think it's great that we have different battery sizes, but I think the dealers are going to have to start being able to have that conversation with the customer. How much battery do you need?
Yeah, definitely. Hey, so speaking of cars, little crossovers coming up, the first shipment of Nissan Ariya electric crossovers hits the UK shores. Martin, are you excited?
Yes, I am.
Yeah, that sounds like some tentative excitement right there.
No, I'm really interested because this is such a high price point for a Nissan. Right. That 52, I think
the equivalent of 52.7, right?
I think the job with the Ariya, and by the way, Nissan, if you're watching, there might well be a podcast that would happily take your sponsorship in order to communicate your brand story here. I think, look, the car is great. Dedicated platform shared with Renault, you know, full active thermal management of the battery, blah, 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 blah. Time to leave the Leaf behind, as good as that was, as good as it is, not offending any Leaf owners. It's a great car for what it's good for. They've got to communicate why you should spend so much money on a Nissan. Because I think a lot of people are going to go, oh, Ariya, yeah, it looks good. Yeah, so £60,000. And like, what for a Nissan? So if they can communicate that story of how good it is, of how the E4 system works and why it's premium and get people inside it and feel it and touch it and is a nice, it's a nice car. But I think that's different to what a lot of people in their head they think Nissan is for, which is like, oh, a 20 or 25 grand car, okay, I know what I'm getting, it's the Nissan badge. And they got a big sell on asking people for that much money.
Yeah, I mean, apparently it's like 43,845 pounds, British pounds, OTR, so on the road. Yeah. So I'm not exactly sure what that includes, but I guess everything you need to get it on the road.
Yeah, there is a registration fee that we can charge, but largely okay. the price in over here, it's different to you guys with sales tax and stuff, but the price that is displayed always has to be the price that you are paying. There's no like, oh, and there's a delivery fee, by the way. That has to be included by law, but there's some extra registration stuff that they add on to that price. But yeah, so, you know, you are up against, so what is the ID? The ID4 used to start at 34,000. Now it starts at 37,000, small battery.
Right.
But yeah, look, you know, you are up against some more expensive EVs. They might be okay if they can do the job of getting people into Nissan dealerships, telling them about how good the Ariya is and selling the benefits. But I think that's the job. Not the car, I think, is good.
Right. Right. Yeah. Especially, interior. I love it. But yeah, so let's move on to what we've been driving this week. How's that?
Hurrah!
Yes. Kyle, so let's talk about what you're doing. So you're still in Europe. You've been in Europe for like, I don't know, 3 weeks now. And you're at the Experience Center in Leipzig today. So this week, You've got a few different, you've been driving a few different things. You drove the Eyeways U5 on the Nürburgring, which is a pretty great video. And you also drove the Shanghai built Tesla Model 3 with like LFP batteries on the Nürburgring with like five people inside of it. Something crazy. Yes.
Yep.
The U5 actually was pretty full too. You only had three people, but then the fourth place was like taken up with luggage, and it's like,
yeah. Well, it was, you know, we had half the team. We had two filming cars for the first half of this trip. We had like a plug-in hybrid Volkswagen RT on shooting break, which is pretty cool. And then we had the Ways U5 to go and film all the videos that have been going out on the channel. And yeah, we just had our camera gear in it, had our luggage, had a whole bunch of stuff, and we're like, let's take it for a lap.
Right. So what did you think about the Eyeways U5 on Nürburgring? Did it tell you anything about the car that you didn't realize before?
No, it wasn't the most important test we've ever done, or right. The most relevant consumer advice. It was more just go out, have a good laugh driving something not built for the track, around the track. Right. And then, yeah, I mean, the Model 3 did really well, but that we actually learned something. Really good thermal management on the LFP car. It really didn't overheat till the end. And the brakes, still major issues. But the thing with that car was the suspension with five people in it. Maybe it wouldn't have happened without five, but we were bottoming out the car everywhere, you know, using full travel. It's almost like they didn't even install bump stops in the suspension. It was very weird. And so we used all the suspension around many corners. And in the video, you'll hear it. It's great.
Right, you're saying there was some rubbing going on. I guess that's the tire with the inner wheel well liner.
Well, that was that's what we thought, but
right,
it's hard to really know. It sounded very tire, but I think actually we may have been scraping the mud flaps, which are factory, underneath the vehicle as well.
Oh, that makes sense. Right, it's got those little tiny, right. And you also. You had half a video talking about the Magna Intelligent Reach.
Oh, this is magical. If you guys are interested in like EVs and powertrain tuning and sort of integration of drivetrain systems, which is my world, right? That's what I nerd out about. This is the video. I know it's not the largest audience that's into this stuff, but
right.
Basically Magna developed a show car to integrate torque vectoring on and off throttle. Normal, we only talk about torque vectoring on throttle. This right. talks about how to actually control vehicle dynamics off throttle better than it's ever been done. It was magical, really crazy experience. And they built this car. I don't even know if I can share the price, but it's north of 5 million euros, this test vehicle. And it was so cool. And they said, like, here are the keys, go drift it. And that's what we did. We destroyed a set of tires till basically they were sparking. It was great.
Wow. Is that all in the video?
I think we didn't film the sparking bit, but okay. All the sliding is in there. Yeah.
Okay, cool. I mean, I watched the two Nürburgring videos, but I didn't get a chance to watch this one. So I'm going to have to go back and watch this one today.
Yeah,
and this
well, is like we don't expect everyone to watch everything. That's why our output is so high. We can't expect everyone to watch, you know, one video a week. That's about, I think, most people's out-of-spec limit.
Right. And that's it's all that technology. They put it all inside a Jaguar I-Pace body. So that's right. What it looks like you're yes. driving. But it's not really a Jaguar I-Pace, though, right? And
right. I guess Jag gets pissed if we call it a Jag.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because okay. It's not their project. It's not. And they just put it in the shell.
Sure.
Yeah. Right but on. Yeah, obviously it's an I-Pace. And so all the car functions as designed, but nothing running the car is factory. It's pretty cool.
So anything else there that you're going to be shooting or talking, but you want to mention that you've been driving?
Well, actually, today we just put up a video talking about how EVs are range tested in EPA and WLTP cycles on a laboratory situation. I think that could be kind of interesting for this audience on out-of-spec reviews. And it's like a deep dive into not necessarily the testing itself, but how the tests are completed. And then in the future, we'll do another video that goes into basically the actual testing cycles and why that may or may not be correct, why WLTP has different results than EPA. I wanted to at least show how they're done, and then we can talk about maybe evaluating the test cycles later.
Right on. So, yeah, All right.
And then I guess maybe I could just show you this really quick, because this is incredible where I am right now at Porsche Center Leipzig.
Yeah.
And we just happened to be driving through, and look at this. This is their testing facility right here and their track. You can see a whole bunch of Porsche experience cars, Taycan wagons. You see that? Isn't that crazy? Chargers all down that way. I don't know if you can see this.
Nice.
But it's just an insane place. You can do factory delivery here of Taycan, which is amazing. And they're all just out ripping around the track, and it's a great place to do this podcast as we were cruising through.
Is that where you are with this new rapid charging park? Is that where are you at the minute, or is that you're somewhere else?
Yeah, so the park, I can't actually walk over there because I'd lose connection, but there's a whole bunch of, I want to say there's probably 20 or 25 Porsche 350 kilowatt DC fast chargers here, all under a solar canopy. So that's what it looked like when it first went in. And then they've pretty much doubled the length and added solar and level two on the other end. It's pretty cool.
Wow. I'm looking at the picture. There's no like overall picture of the whole kind of thing.
Yeah. So I'm basically in that sphere. I'm on the outer edge of it on the left side, right up that ramp in the back of this photo. But the crazy thing is, when this photo launched, when this park was put in 2020, this was the craziest thing. I remember looking at photos of this going, wow, this is the future. It's so wild. And then the other day, I just filmed a video of a place that has almost 80 DC fast chargers.
Wow.
I mean, the whole EV world is getting wild. I love it.
Right on.
But awesome. Props to Porsche for being super forward thinking in e-mobility. They're doing it better than almost any other brand, I would say. And it's not like they invited us here. We just showed up to get a coffee. They just had a little coffee shop here.
Is this open to everyone, or is it Porsche's only?
Yeah, no, we pulled in with the ID5. That we didn't tell anyone we were coming. We just rolled up, said, hey, we're here to do a show. They handed us visitor passes, and we're just here hanging out.
Thank you, Porsche. Thank you for making the podcast happen this afternoon, because you are,
thanks,
I think you're 1 hour or 2 hours. I think you're 1 hour ahead of me. So it's like 20 past four your time. So
yes.
Thank you, Porsche. That's very kind of you.
Yes, it is. Thanks, Porsche.
All right.
Very expensive coffee, though, as you would expect.
Absolutely. Well, welcome to Germany.
On the experience side, I should also mention that on the Out of Spec Motoring channel, that Alyssa has her own video this week, and she is with Liv from the Mach-E folks.
And yep, Mach-E Vlog.
Mach-E Vlog channel. And they did some dog rescuing in the R1T this week. So if you're into like watching, you know, travel videos, doing cool stuff, that's something.
I thought this was a great video. I really enjoyed this. I didn't actually even know they were really doing this or filming a video. We've been over here.
Okay.
And I watched this after it went live, and I was like, wow, this is a great video. So I would encourage you to watch this. It was really fun.
Yeah, I haven't watched the whole thing yet. I've watched up to this part. I got to see the dog.
Thank you.
That was great. And it's loaded up and putting the truck to work. That looks great. All right.
Kyle, that t-shirt that Alyssa's wearing doesn't reference you, does it?
She kisses dogs.
You know, Katy Perry song. I like that.
Yep. Yep, that was good. And honestly, massive charging issues on this trip for her and Liv, you know, both. It's so just, you know, basically I've been showing, okay, hey, you know, when we show up to a charger, we always show what happens and, you know, totally unbiased. Does it work? Does it not work? If it doesn't work, in my opinion, totally sucks. That's like the worst experience you could ever give someone. If it works, like, okay, that's as expected. And so in Alyssa's case, every single stop on this trip, I think except for one, was unplugging, replugging, moving things around, having issues, and it was just kind of annoying.
Right. Yeah, that's never great. All right. Hey, so Tom, you were driving some Porsche Taycans this week. So the Porsche Taycan got a big software update, so you got more range and charging power gains. I don't know. You tell us about it. What's going on with that?
Yeah. So good that Martin brought up the article. We have a full article on Inside EVs if you want to learn everything what's included in the software update. But basically, Porsche is putting out this software update for all existing Taycan, over 75,000 of them worldwide, and it's got a lot of improvements. There's a infotainment system now has color tiles. Before they were, you know, they weren't color, and that's one of the obvious things you notice when you get in the car. But there was a lot of powertrain efficiency improvements, charging efficiency improvements, basically many parts of the vehicle. Also, future over-the-air updates now are, there's more things that can be updated through over-the-air updates after you get this update. But unfortunately, this update is not an over-the-air update. Right. You've got to bring it to your dealer to have it done. It's a full day at the dealership from what I understand. But what it's, one of the things it does is making for future, more things can be updated over the air. So there's a bunch of improvements. So what happened was Porsche reached out to me and said, look, one of the things that this is doing is increasing the driving range through a bunch of different, a lot of little improvements that they made. Would you like to hop in one and do a range test? We know you've range test pretty much all of the Taycans already, you and Kyle have. And so I said, sure. So I went down to Atlanta actually yesterday and did, I got a rear wheel drive with the Performance Plus battery pack, aero wheels, and took it on a range test. We're gonna hold off on the results because I want to get that video all put together and put out. But what I will say is I did the same range test on the same vehicle, slightly different wheels, but they're both aero wheels, about 9 months ago. And on this range test, I exceeded my results from that range test. And I ended up with 297 miles in that range test. Kyle did the same range test on a similarly spec'd Taycan, and he went 293. So, I mean, we were 293, 297. I mean, that's, you know, you can't get closer than that, you know?
Right.
And, but I exceeded both of those in the range test, and the weather conditions were poor for range test. I had 14 mile an hour winds. It was raining for a short part of the range test. And I wasn't on flat terrain. I was on, I went up and down, I didn't climb a mountain, but I think there was like a 700 foot elevation change that I was going up and down as I was circling. So, you know, you take all those things into consideration, and I still beat the final result that Kyle and I did on the vehicle last year. And that shows that, you know, they have made improvements in the range. But what I will say is, and the funny thing is, I didn't realize it till I got down there. And even Calvin Kim, product manager for, you know, the Taycan for the U.S., he actually didn't realize either. We started talking about this, and he's like, you know, I actually should have given you a different Taycan. My instinct was to give you this one because it's the longest range, it's rear wheel drive. But one of the biggest advancements they made was how the front motor decouples and de-energizes during, when you're driving on the highway and you don't need that extra power. And this is a rear wheel drive, so you're losing like most of the efficiency gains that we had by not having the front wheel, the all wheel drive version. But he's like, all right, we'll get you one of those next. But I was the first person to drive a Taycan outside of the company with this new software. And it's going to be standard on the 2023 models, which are just starting to be built now. On all Taycans. So, and it's the interesting thing is when I did the Taycan GTS and the GTS Sport Turismo press drive like 4 or 5 months ago, the EPA range rating and WLTP range ratings for those vehicles was higher than for the previous Taycans. And we're like, how can that be? You know, the sport versions, they have even wider tires. Why would they have it? But it was because they were going to start off with this new software. So, okay. You know, the EPA range rating for the vehicle that I drove is 225, but that's kind of like the old EPA range rating. They haven't range tested it yet. I assume for the 2023 model year, Kyle's shaking his head. I assume that they're going to test it and put out a new, we don't know that for sure. I actually asked Calvin if that's going to happen, on camera, and we'll have to wait to see what his answer was. But, I have a little short interview with him, and that'll be put up in the video in about a week. It'll be inside of these, that range test. And we also talk about what this new software update is doing for the Taycan line.
Cool. Any Porsche Taycan questions there, Kyle?
So I mean, sounds good. Totally agree with you guys. The all-wheel drive would have been better. The thing to realize with this software update is it's sort of like a lot of the cars have had bits of this update as production has gone on. So right. A lot of the all-wheel drive efficiency improvements from like model year 21 had a lot of these improvements in there. Now it's the next step forward. But very quickly after start of production, now looking back on it, the rear motor stopped being disconnected. So they have the whole rear disconnect switch in the back. And I want to say it was model year, like late 20, early 21, somewhere around there. They physically stopped disconnecting the rear motor. When we did the Cannonball in the 4S, we actually felt like that system was wearing down over time because we kept reconnecting it under hard load over and over and over. And that car had some weird issues and it threw some fault codes after our test. But now it seems like they're trying to de-energize the front motor. I don't know how that's possible, though, because they're two permanent magnet motors. You cannot physically de-energize it. You do need to apply some torque so you don't have flux-related losses in a permanent magnet motor. So my guess is it's still, if they applied all of these efficiency improvements and decoupled the rear motor, that might still be better than what they're doing now, which is leaving everything hooked up and trying to basically have the front motor create the least amount of drag resistance as possible. And then the big story here is the charging. It's the car is going to precondition quicker, more aggressive setting. It's going to precondition hotter, especially at higher states of charge. If you get to a charger with 40% state of charge, it's no longer going to heat up to 94, 95 degrees Fahrenheit. It's going to get up to 104, 105 so that you have less resistance in the pack for high power charging deeper in. Overall, again, and I've driven cars with bits of these updates throughout the last few years. And we have one that we're picking up tomorrow or in a couple days that has all this stuff too. So we'll try it out with high speed, high charging, deep charging rates here in Germany on the autobahns and stuff like that. But very important update. I hate the colored icons though. I think it looks so cheesy.
Kind of looks like Apple to me. In any event, let me talk a little bit about the charging improvements in layman's terms. You know, Kyle had a little bit more technical, even though it wasn't deep technical. Basically, the car's not going to charge fast. The optimal charging curve won't change. 5% to 80%, 22 and a half minutes. But you'll be able to achieve the optimal charging curve under a greater variety of conditions. Whereas before, you had to arrive at a certain battery percentage. And I remember when I was doing my charge recordings, you know, just working the car so I can get it. It had to be over 93 degrees Fahrenheit, something like 32 Celsius or something like that, in order to get the peak 270 kilowatt. And then if it got too hot, it would also derate. But now they've opened up the temperature range for it to be able to charge at its peak rate and at higher states of charge. So, you know, most people don't analyze charging like Kyle and I do, or other people like, you know, on YouTube or so whatever. People just go and plug their car in and they're not going to look at, oh, it's 265 kilowatt now, which, you know, it's not 270 or whatever, but the time to charge is what they're most interested in. And most people are going to see, in most charging instances, they're going to see shorter time, because very few people before were able to arrive at the, you know, peak state of charge at peak battery temperature and achieve peak charging rates. But now more people will be able to.
Right on. That's great.
And what's the deal with plug and charge and the Taycan at the moment?
Yeah. So plug and charge was introduced in, I think, mid-2021 for the Taycan. It didn't launch with it. That's not included in this software update, but customers that want to have plug-in charge that have a 2020 or the first half of 2021 will be able to take their car to the dealer and get plug-in charge. I don't think it's available just yet, but very soon you're going to be able to do that. And also, if you didn't get the 22 kilowatt onboard charger, you will be able to bring to the dealership and upgrade from your 11 kilowatt charger to 22 kilowatt. Now here in the US, it really is only 19 kilowatt, but they call it the 22 kilowatt charger. Those two things too. Older Taycan owners, Porsche isn't forgetting the original, you know, year and a half Taycan owners that didn't have the higher charge onboard charging and plug-in charge. If you have a 2020 model or 2021 first half a year, you'll be able to get that if you'd like.
And how are they making the battery hotter? Are they using up electrical energy so in the battery pack to generate heat, or are they doing something more funky with scavenging heat better from other components? Do they tell you that?
Yeah, they are scavenging heat from components. Absolutely. But it's
also ripping the heater more.
Yeah.
Oh, really?
But they have optimized the amount of heat that they scavenge from the powertrain. That's part of this software update.
Okay.
Cool.
That's cool. And very cool that it goes back for all owners, right? There's nothing worse than owning a phone or a tablet and then Apple or Android do an update and you're like, oh man, my phone's too old for this one. So very cool that they're looking after the installed car park.
100%, Martin. That's what really impressed me, because, you know, with electric vehicles, every year you were seeing, you know, improved, you know, optimization of powertrains, improved features. It's like cell phones. You know, we didn't get that with the combustion cars, that big of a difference so quickly. Every year there's improvements. You buy a car this year, $150,000 Taycan. Next year, you know, there's 10 things you didn't get. So I really appreciate that Porsche did this and said, look, if you were one of our first customers back in 2020, you'll be able to basically have everything that a new customer has. If you want. So that, I think that's really good.
Yeah, that's awesome. Hey, so keeping in line with top end sports, electric sports cars and things, I had the Chevy Bolt EV for a week.
And, that's great.
it is not a top end sports car. Actually, so my daily driver is a Chevy Spark EV 2015. So it's got the 19 kilowatt hour battery in it and with limited range. So having the Bolt, it was a bit of an eye opener. So I've been, you know, I'm thinking about trying to buy a Bolt, and there's a bunch of stuff going on. I'm struggling here. But now I have a good idea of what to expect, because before I had like a short, you know, 5 minute, whatever drive from the dealership to experience the Bolt. And it, you know, driving it this time, I found it was really different than my memory of it. So it's not as fun to drive as the Spark EV. It's got more power. But the Spark EV is like smaller, and it just, you know, I guess the sense of speed is more, but it's also, you know, just more, it's just quicker. It's just more responsive and got a better steering feel. But not to knock the Chevy Bolt. I mean, the Chevy Bolt is really good for, you know, what it is. It's a more robust car. So like with my Spark, I'm very careful. Every time I even like open the door, I'm like, just gentle, and I close it. I just, you know, because you could breathe on it and dent, you can see dented sparks all over the place. You know, they sold a lot of sparks in this country, and you can breathe on it, and they're just not the most robust cars, but the Chevy Bolt is, you know, it's like a solid, proper car, and it doesn't have quite have the dynamics, but it is, you know, plenty quick. Like in traffic, you're doing 20 miles an hour and you want to pass somebody, you don't have to worry about, you know, not having the speed or whatever. It's all the power is there under your, I think it's like a 6 second 0-60 in that neighborhood. So that's proper quick. It only goes 92 miles an hour. Apparently, I drove it quickly down to Mexico and tried at top speed.
Yeah. How was the weather down in Mexico? Must have been nice.
It was very nice. but I did find it a safe place to try it out, and I did that, and I also did like an emergency stop, like hard, like probably 60 miles an hour to zero, you know, full ABS stop, like, and it was like, it tracks straight, did everything it's supposed to. But what I really enjoyed about this was like the range. So I think it's like a 250-ish miles or 258 miles of range on they re-updated. Originally, it was 239 or 238 or something. And they increased the size of the battery slightly. I think it's got a 66 kilowatt hour battery in it now. And so, you know, I could drive to the beach, which is like 100 miles away and back, and with plenty of range. And I didn't have to. And I took it easy on the way down there. I went down and took some pictures, and I'll have a review up hopefully this week. And I had... you know, tons of range. Like I went there and went back, and I didn't spare the horses on the way back because it was late. I needed to get back. So yeah, it was kind of great. And, you know, you still have to fold down the rear seats if you want to stick a guitar in the back. Like I do my Spark, my rear seats are always down because I'm always sticking my guitar in there and going places. But I'm not really sure. Also, the suspension was nice. It was nice and pliant over the rough. You know, it's not crazy, but for the money. So now they're selling this for $26,000, $26,500 or something.
Is that your target price then for what you want to pay for one? $26,000?
Yes.
Okay. Yes.
I don't want to pay over
MSRP. That seems very reasonable for a car that goes that far.
Yeah. No, it's because the only place it really falls down is the charging. It's, you know, maxes out at 50 kilowatts charging, which is not great. So,
yeah, but if you don't need to DC charge it, that car is amazing at the value. It's got plenty of space. It's pretty comfortable, I think. And it's got, you know, good CarPlay, great sound system, by the way, in the nice one. Yeah, right. Really good.
Yeah.
I had the 2LT.
I totally agree with Kyle. It's what a deal of a car you get for that price point, as long as you don't need to go on frequent long road trips. And most people don't, you know, but if you do, don't buy the Bolt. I'll tell you just how bad it is. I recently had the Bolt. I did the range test and I was trying to get the charging test. So it takes 2.5 hours, a little longer than 2.5 hours to go from 0 to 100%. Now, most people aren't going to charge 0 to 100%. So no, the Bolt doesn't take 2.5 hours to charge before people write this. Right. You know, you can charge to 80%, move on. It's got great range, but we like to do the whole charging curve. So it's more than 2.5 hours. The first recording I tried to do, my battery died on my camera. I even had two batteries and I swapped it and it couldn't do it. Now it was 95 degrees. It was hot out. So that's part of it. So then I tried to do it the next day or not the next day, a couple of days later, I drove it back down to zero, went out early in the morning. And instead of using my camera, I used I have a Pixel 5 that I don't use as my phone. It was my old phone, but it does good charge recordings for this. It went so long and I had it on like 30 times speed. The phone overheated and it ruined the phone. My phone, I had to throw it out because it like got so hot. It didn't just shut off. It like melted the phone. So two charge recordings, I'm 0 for 2. I had to return the car and it ruined my phone. So the DC fast charging on the Bolt is terrible, but it's a great car. Not everybody needs fantastic, robust DC fast charging. If you could charge this thing at home and you don't really need to, I mean, you could do a road trip, you know, if you had to stop once or twice, but you just have to bake in an hour to an hour and a half stop, you know, even just to get it to you know, over an hour to get to 80%.
And we'll have to see how available these things are at MSRP, because, you know, they just had all the batteries replaced. The Bolt, Chevy Bolt EV went to a extensive recall. So every Bolt ever made is having this battery replaced. So we're not sure what that does to, you know, consumer confidence in the product. We'll have to see. So maybe I think there's as good a chance of getting this at MSRP as pretty much any other electric vehicle from most manufacturers. Of course, Tesla doesn't mark up, and I think Polestar as well. You can get a Polestar at what they say the price is. There's no dealer marking up on those. But it was great.
And you're going to lose no money on it. You could sell that in 3 years for what you bought it for. Like, wow. I did a story this week about lithium mining. Deep, deep, deep stuff. Okay. But the average between 2010 and 2020 of all the mines that were in this survey, the average time it takes to develop a lithium mine is 16 and a half years. And people are starting to go, hey, I reckon we need more lithium. Now, it's not the problem that it's in the ground. There's loads of it. It's that there's not enough high-grade stuff that's easy to get and to refine it and to process it, make it into batteries and sell you a car. Like, this shortage of EVs is not a short-term or mid-term problem. We are going to be short of EVs for the next decade. So, yeah, if you buy that Bolt for 26, you're going to sell it in 3 years' time for not much less, you know.
Okay. I mean, but Chevy is going to have some very competitive product with its own product. I'm not sure if they'll even offer the Chevy Bolt in a couple of years.
But think of the price point differences. I mean, I think, you know, where the Bolt's going is it's going down. The other ones will go up.
Right. Yeah. But the Chevy Equinox is coming out soon, and that's rumored to be in like the 30,000 neighborhood. Oh,
maybe
right?
That'll so push. That might push the Bolt down a bit. Yeah. But look, EVs are not going to have a bottom price like combustion cars that go down and down and down because they're worthless at the end of their life. They're always going to have a minimum value that it is bad in a way because, you know, my first car was a Fiat Panda, then a Fiat Uno, then a Fiat Cinquecento, right? They're terrible small city car. But I, you know, my first three cars were tiny Italian, but they were cheap, right? So that's not gonna, which is a problem for everyone's first car or for the third hand, fourth hand market, because they're just not gonna get as cheap as all the cars that we drove as our first car. So that's an issue, but I think all these cars will hold their value. I wouldn't worry about values.
Nathan Green mentions that Dom, 2023 ordering should start soon with the lower MSRP.
Hasn't it started?
Right. So let's see.
No,
so
end of July.
Right, but they're giving they're putting money on the hood of the cars they're selling now. So they're effectively selling at that future price now, basically. But last thing I just want to say about the Bolt was that the interior was refreshed and the exterior. I think I like the original face a bit better. I was watching the new one. It's like I don't really like the feel of the plastic. I like the harder glass on the front of the first one, and it's a little happier. The new one's a little scowly. It's kind of more modern, but you know, whatever. It's neither here nor there. But the interior is like such a huge improvement. So I had the 2LT and it had the nice Bose system installed. So the stereo was not bad. It was great. I listened to channel, I think it's 349 on Sirius XM. That's Dwight Yoakam's channel. It was great for a whole week. I have a Sirius XM on my car, or I can get it, but I can't get those channels for whatever reason. It's really bizarre. So whatever, that's just a little small aside. I had some great tunage this week. I'm a big Dwight Yoakam fan, and I just want to mention, and the seats also, they weren't leather, they weren't terribly uncomfortable. They were pretty solid, but it's like a vinyl, very like a thick vinyl. I think it'll wear really well, and they look decent. Anyway, overall, I think Bolt EV is a great buy, like Tom was saying. It's a good deal. I also want to mention that this week I got to drive the Tesla Model 3 Performance on a track in actually the Michelin Proving Grounds in South Carolina. Have you ever been there, Kyle?
Never been to it.
Yeah, this is my first time on a track. It was great, and they had like the corners, and it was so fun, like just doing like the, you know, hitting the apexes and stuff. Because I've always wanted to be on a track, and I was like, how hard is that possible? Apparently it comes pretty instinctively. It's pretty fun. So
that's great.
I was there for Brembo. Brembo brought us there for the Brembo Sensify system to check that out. So this is pretty interesting. So we got on the track, and there's a stock Tesla Model 3 with its stock brakes performance, Tesla Model 3 Performance. And we did like some emergency braking under different circumstances, dry pavement, wet pavement, straight line, emergency maneuvers, in a turn, stopping in a turn. And, you know, the Tesla Model 3 performed this like amazingly well. Like I was so surprised. You get in, especially like the emergency lane change maneuver, like you're hitting full ABS braking, but you still need to, you know, spin around a like an obstacle in the road, no problem. It's like complete steerability under the hardest braking, and it tracks. It was like perfect. So then we got in the system with Brembo. So Martin's sharing some pictures of the wheels. We'll talk about this in a second. This picture on the screen now, that's the rear wheel on a car. And that's got an electromechanical brake on it instead of the regular hydraulic brakes. So the test cars had what they call wet brakes in the front, hydraulic brakes, and these dry brakes or electromechanical brakes in the rear. And they say that it seems like they want to switch everything to electromechanical brakes in the future. So that's something to look out for. But so we did these same maneuvers with the Brembo Sensify system. And once. Oops, there we are. I think I took myself off the screen. So yeah, so we did the same things with the Brembo Sensify system, and so I didn't know what to expect. I didn't read the literature before I got there. I didn't hunt it down, and I wanted to see what I wanted to have an open mind, so and experience it as it happened. So we went in, did that, the braking things, and like it's like it didn't stop any quicker. And so I was a little confused at the first stop. So we went on to the next stop. And I think, I'm not sure when it was. I think it was maybe the emergency maneuver stop in the wet. It really kind of struck me like it's quiet. There was no So when you hit the brakes like that hard at speed, and we were stopping sometimes up to 70 miles an hour and doing emergency stops, the ABS system kicks in, and so the brake pads are like squeezing the rotors like many times a second to sort of pump the brakes and keep the wheels from locking up. That allows you to keep control. So with this new system, that doesn't happen. There's no ABS going on. There's no pumping of anything. So that introduces a lot of vibration and sound to the feet and your wheels. And it puts a load on your brain because there's a lot going on. If you're hitting your brakes that hard, generally there's like a lot going on already. And so this reduces basically that sort of sensory input, basically. So it just, you can stop emergency and do what you need to do, but there's no drama. It's like, it was pretty amazing. Like when you actually do it, it was like, okay, this is good. I can see this. Yeah. Anyway, anyone have any questions?
So can you explain how it does anti-lock? Does it just target a deceleration rate of the tire to be a little bit slower than vehicle movement, or what's it doing?
So every wheel gets its own, its own braking pattern sort of thing going on. And actually the wheel speeds, it's keeping every wheel speed. I don't know. It's monitoring and stopping every wheel separately. You know, it's like, I don't know how to
right. explain. So you have individual braking pressure on each wheel to keep them at their maximum deceleration rate without locking.
Right.
But how is the brake actually being actuated? You mentioned it's an electric motor that's putting pressure to clamp, or what exactly is going on in the rear?
On the rear brakes, yeah, they're using electrical impulses. But it's funny, they said it's not brake by wire, but it kind of is, you know. But it does still have the hydraulic system in the front. Sorry? I think you're muted. You're muted.
Sorry. It would have to be a braking by signal situation.
Sure, yeah.
Because there's processing logic that goes into this. It can't just be a physical brake pedal connection.
Right, right, definitely. It's like that. It's like a, you know, you hit the brakes, it puts out a signal. And so on the hydraulic system, it valves the left and right side, each tire slightly differently. And then on the rear, it's doing that slightly differently as far as like the wheel speeds. And they showed us some graphing of the wheel speeds under braking and everything too. And it was interesting to see how they don't lock up. I don't know. It's hard to really explain it super deep. I need to write this up, and that's when I'm really going to delve into the super technical diff. They explained it somewhat to us, but I think there's like a lot of engineering speak that, you know, they don't really use with us because it's kind of maybe beyond our abilities to quite understand. But anyway, it was an impressive system. I think it's something to watch out for.
And I wonder how the brakes of our future EVs will change given increasing strength of regen versus the need to stop quickly when we need to. We've seen the VW cars go for the rear drum brakes, advantages to those. But I wonder how brakes will evolve given we don't need them very much, but when you need them, you really need them. So that's interesting.
Right.
I look forward to reading that, Dom.
Right. Yeah, I was curious about this trip because I was like, okay, electric vehicles and braking, when we think of electric vehicles and braking, we're thinking of regen, but this was not that at all. And this is a mature technology at this point. They have their talks with different OEMs about putting it into products. So we could see this in product. I think they were saying the end of 2024. They didn't say which products, but we were driving Teslas. I think there might be a possibility. Brembo and Tesla. Ooh, that would be.
Well, they already have a collaboration. They do all the braking for Tesla now.
Right. But it's not really branded. It's not really, you know, they don't really talk about that too much, I don't think. But anyway.
Well, Brembo's got to be the largest brake supplier. Anyway, it seems pretty cool. I like the idea of not having technically ABS, but just holding a constant, sort of pressure on a wheel and having it change. I think it could be cool. The benefit with ABS is when you let go, you can see if you're still locking or not, right? That's how that system kind of works. And then this should just be able to pull a consistent pressure on that particular wheel that's locking.
Yeah. Yeah. There's no, I mean, yeah, there's no lockup. It's just an incredibly short, even with the regular brakes, you know, just incredibly short stopping distances. Like, because you're going to, you're approaching the gate, you know, and you can see like the little space that you have to stop and then and turn or whatever. And it's like, man, I don't, can cars do that? I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, just like if you get a good tire on the car, it stops way quicker than people think.
Yeah, Aziz had good tires on. I think they were Michelin Sport 4s, possibly. I took pictures of them, yep. But I didn't take notes of that part. But yeah.
I don't know if we put it in the show or not, but maybe I could just talk about the most incredible, crazy thing I got to do last couple days ago.
Yeah.
So do you guys remember the Volkswagen XL1, which was really the first plug-in hybrid, but sort of a showcase of Volkswagen's, I guess, efficiency? The whole goal was for it to use less than 1 liter of fuel per 100 kilometers driven. So it's technically rated in NEDC at 0.9 liters per 100K. But it's a plug-in hybrid, and it's this really cool thing. Anyway, they pulled one out of the development sort of garage that it sat for the last 6 years, slow charged up the battery, unbricked the car, polished it up, and they let me and Jordan have it for the day. And we drove it all around, and it was awesome. So we have a whole video going. We got to meet one of the original engineers who worked on this project. And basically, he had not seen the car for 6 years, and he had been dying to. So we brought it to him. We went for a drive together. We talked about the early stages. And we also brought along our ID.5 GTX to talk about sort of what Volkswagen was thinking back then, what their strategy is now. And it was a really cool tie-in of like the first hyper-efficient car from them to the EVs they're making today. I really enjoyed it.
Sorry, I meant to mention that or prompt you to talk about this earlier in the show, because yeah, the XL1 is like a iconic car. It's really expensive, and of course, it's made to be, you know, super efficient. So, what did you do? You drove it as least efficient as possible. Is that
well? I did both. So we tried to see what's the best efficiency we can get out of it cruising on the highway, and what's the, you know, go shred it up some roads and try and get the worst efficiency. Even driving it as least efficiently as we could, it was still more efficient than anything else I've ever driven. It was pretty cool.
Right. Is it pretty pokey? But how was the performance?
Oh yeah. Not great. Not good.
Okay. Handling?
Yeah, slow. Zero. No, none of that. That word does not exist. No handling. It's on 115s. You just go into a corner, but there's no grip. So.
They're only 108,000 euros to buy one, so that's okay.
Okay, so there's this one, and then there's one other silver one that is the same price with 1,900 kilometers on it.
Ooh.
Because after experiencing this, I was eyeing it, and I'm like, oh, how cool would this be to have one of these over here? So I just fell in love with it. I think it's a great car.
Right.
I never had the chance to drive one, but I did drive M1, I think, at the 2013 LA Auto Show, maybe 2014, but I think it was 2013. And they were giving out drives during the press days. So I got to drive all around LA in it, but not as the driver, which was pretty cool.
Right. I understand that the drive is like a little harsh and noisy. Is that true?
I wouldn't say a little. It's like you can't hear a dang thing other than the diesel in the back screaming away. It's hilarious. It's a no compromise, hardcore approach to efficiency, right? Okay. So it's okay. Efficiency is top priority. That means NVH, handling, acceleration, styling, maybe depending on who you are. These all take secondary approaches to just getting the least amount of fuel used to drive. Again, this is, you know, I really wish they kind of kept the same culture of making crazy cool development vehicles in the EV space. Like, I'd love to see what an XL1 would be today with the EV focus we have going forwards. I think it would be so much cooler than this.
Well, Mercedes made that, and they call it the EV XX or something.
Right. Yep. Yeah.
Yeah. Which is doing great. Which is like kind of what you're talking about, like a super high efficiency sort of technology demonstrator, but they're not even going to sell that, the Mercedes, but VW actually did sell some XL1s.
Right, that's what makes it cool.
Yeah.
We always talk about it doesn't exist until someone can buy one.
Right.
And so this actually exists because there's people that have well over 100,000 kilometers daily driving these things still.
Wow.
I think the Aptera is kind of like that, Kyle, right? Like a design in ultra efficiency, which I know we're up against it now. It's an hour and a half. We pretty much have to end the show. Yeah. But before we do, what I want to throw out to all you guys is, what did you think about Aptera's, you know, their, what was it?
Charge connector?
Yeah, how they're trying to get the petition is what the word I was trying to pull out.
They are petitioning
the U.S. government to make Tesla the standard adapter. I'd like to hear your opinions.
Well, this blew up on Kyle on your Twitter, so you're best to talk to this.
So I approached it from an open mind. So look, here's the thing: if there's ever going to be a change, every single day that goes by is going to make that harder. The problem is, this was a conversation 4 years ago we should have had rather than now. And to me, it just personally seems a lot more of a publicity stunt than does it seem like they actually care. Yes. I don't think anyone would argue the point that the Tesla plug is more elegant, easier to use, much nicer than CCS1. It's just an overall nicer end connection. But it's just not going to happen. Like, I don't even think this is worth thinking about. Now, if they get it to the point where it happens, I would be thrilled. I think that would be so cool. I would much prefer the Tesla plug everywhere. It's just like, okay, we got enough problems to deal with. Let's just everyone's agreed on CCS1. Let's just stick with that and figure out everything else at the moment.
Yeah, I'm pretty much with you there. Great marketing exercise. I'm not going to happen.
What do you think? I don't know. Was it a great marketing exercise? To me, they take it wasn't a good move. I think it makes them look like Bush League. Like, why are you pushing for this? Like, why would you, you know, is Aptera trying to get on Elon's good side by you know, putting this out there? We know that they've wanted to use the Tesla connector because you show it in their pictures. I've talked to them about it and just kind of got the answers. Well, we'll have to wait and see. They obviously wanted to use the Tesla connector. So, I mean, do they think that, you know, by promoting it like this, they'll get Tesla's blessing to use it on their vehicles? I'm curious to where they're going with this. It shouldn't be a car manufacturer putting this petition out, in my opinion. Oh, nobody should do it. But if someone were to do it, not a startup.
At the end of the day, I think this is going to help them because this is going to be a secondary EV for a lot of people that already own Teslas. And so I think it's not a bad move in the end. I just think it's not going to change the industry. It's not going to make any difference. And it's purely marketing. Guess what? I think actually, while it does seem a bit slimy, and I agree with you, Tom, I think it's going to work for them in the long run.
Definitely got some "Hey, look at me, senpai" kind of vibes going on, but I think it did because Aptera is not a household name, and I think pointing out there. I mean, I think this whole little thing that they've created, you know, we're talking about it, and other people are talking about it, and so a whole lot of people who aren't aware of Aptera or the history of the company or the car or whatever now know about it, and at least it's on their radar. I don't know. Martin, you have any thoughts?
Yeah, I think it did them massive harm. I used to rate Aptera very highly. I want to see them. They've got a factory now this week, which is a good thing. But I think it really hurts them because if you pay attention to what they were saying, it's that the CCS1 standard or the CCS standard sucks and Tesla is better. Therefore, we should all use it. There's no argument that the Tesla plug is smaller, more elegant. It's beautiful. It's very high power. But if you think about their argument, this is why it puts them into the amateur leagues in my mind, is that what they are advocating for is basically like the end of this Apple phone is a Lightning connector. And what they're arguing for is if every Android phone had to have this Lightning connector, and in the morning, Tim Cook wakes up and burps and decides your licensing fee is twice as much, the Android community would be like, no, we're going back to USB-C. And it's the same with the Tesla connector. And although the Tesla people say to me, oh, but they're all open source patents, they're not. It's a commonly held misconception with Tesla. It's not out there. They make them available until at which point Tesla can retract them. It's not true open source. They've put them out there. Anyone's free to use them. But Tesla have retained the right. It's not true open source. So at any point in 15 years, Elon Musk wakes up on the wrong side of the bed, and now you're not using my plug anymore. That, my friends, Aptera, that, my friends, is not a great standard for us all to be using, that one company control. And so when you think about their argument, It's terrible. And it really, in my head, harmed Aptera. Like, these guys are complete amateurs. If you're making the argument based on standards, you want us to use a closed, not an open standard? Like, that's the opposite of what we should be doing. Come on. Think about it. No argument that Tesla is much better.
Right.
I may be wrong.
Right.
There's a Taycan doing a full drift behind me. It's
that's
great.
More important. That's more important than what I said.
That's the news we need.
Sorry, Martin.
No, okay. It's more important because this is nonsense. Shut up, Aptera. Go away. Okay. Go make a great car.
There we go. That's what we want.
Let's end on that note. Martin gets the last word.
They're not sponsoring my podcast anymore.
No, I mean,
wait a minute. You know, my position, me and Martin are kind of on the same line with this. We think it was a bad move. Kyle thinks it was a good move. Dominic, we need your answer. Good move, bad move?
I thought overall it was a good move.
Okay. Sorry, well, we're deadlocked.
That's good. 50-50.
But yeah. I thought they were great guys. They came on our show and we have an episode with them and talked to them. And, you know, I like what they're doing. And I'm not convinced totally yet that they're going to achieve like job one, like delivering the first one. But, you know, we'll see. I mean, I hope that happens. But I mean, that's up. It's all down to another episode. Sorry?
Time will tell what happens to them. At the end of the day, my guess is they'll be using the CCS plug.
Yes, that's what's going to happen. CCS it is. All right, so that brings us to the end of our show. If you have any questions or comments, you can leave them on the Inside EVs forum podcast thread or on our YouTube or Twitch comment sections. If you like the show, please give us a thumbs up if you're watching us on YouTube. Don't forget, you can find and follow our panelists on Twitter. Follow Tom Malogny at Tomalog. That's with two M's. Martin Lee is at EV News Daily. Kyle Connor is at It's Kyle Connor. And I'm at Dominic_Y. Click subscribe, tap that bell icon for notifications, and we'll see you all again next week. Ciao. Woohoo!